Please, the book of Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes chapter 1. So good to be with y'all again this evening. We have a good crowd again tonight, and it's so good to be with y'all, to worship our Father, to be able to take our voices up to Him, and to take time away from this holiday season. I love Christmas. As I've made clear this morning, I've always loved this time of year, but I do know that for some people, the holidays are just really tough. It brings back the people who aren't here. It brings back just memories of people that we've lost, and it brings back oftentimes just a lot of heartache. And if so, you'll be my prayers this week. I know that for some of us, we turn into 12-year-olds again, and it just becomes a great little exciting week. But there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of heartache, and if you are here tonight, and I'm sure we have at least some, you'll be in my prayers this week, and I do hope that you do find comfort in our Father in this week. As y'all know, I preached a series of lessons up at the church in Lafayette in the month of November, that were focused on foundational questions that we need to ask. So the genesis and idea behind the series was trying to ask, what are the questions that just everybody needs to answer in life? And so as we began to brainstorm about this, we came to recognize that the most foundational question that anyone can ask in any walk of life, and the most foundational question that affects everything else that we believe and do is, does God exist? So I'm going to present a variation of that tonight. I recognized as I was looking back through my sermons, I don't think I've ever preached a sermon here, even a few years ago or in the last few months, about does God exist? And it just struck me odd that, you know, the most foundational question I've never really spoken on, because it's something we just assume, right? And I'm sure that for many of you, when you were growing up, it was just assumed that God exists. I mean, as I've talked to my grandparents, both of whom were raised, or all four of my grandparents really, were raised in the country of Kentucky back in, you know, the good old days. Everyone believed in God. And they said for there to be an atheist, they didn't know what the term meant. I mean, let alone what an agnostic was. And it was just pretty much assumed, yeah, God exists. Now, people didn't disagree about what God had said, or whether the Bible was His word, etc. But it was pretty much assumed that God exists. I don't think we can make that assumption anymore. I mean, we have people that come into our number, we can't assume that they believe in a higher being. Whenever we have coworkers, we can't assume that they believe that there's a creator. In our day, the belief in a higher power, the belief in God, is becoming in many ways more questioned. I mean, I have multiple students, colleagues, etc., who are very militant atheists. And in academia in general, you will find militant atheists who just utterly hate the idea of a God. But what I want to do this evening is try to answer this foundational question. Now, we could take this from multiple perspectives, but I do want to go to the Bible to answer this. The Bible does make a claim for God, and it may be that you're here tonight and you're questioning this. I question this. I mean, ironically, when I was at Florida College, a school that has a lot of Christian faculty and a lot of Christian environment, my faith was deeply questioned. I mean, I got to a point where I honestly just wasn't sure whether or not there was a creator. And for some of you, that's just unfathomable. But as I began to engage some of the deeper philosophers and just some of the deeper questions of life, I came to recognize my own belief in God was in many ways unwarranted. I kind of assumed it, kind of believed it, but I really didn't know why. And I do believe in God 100%. I do believe there's a creator. I do believe that there's a savior. I do believe that there is a higher power. But how do we know God exists? So what we're going to do tonight is this. We're going to go into the book of Ecclesiastes, just chapters 1 and 2, and answer this question, does God exist? So we're going to go into Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and 2, and I'm going to use this as a transition point to talk about the concept of a worldview. I'll define that as we get to it. But let's go and go into the book of Ecclesiastes. So overall, the book of Ecclesiastes is all about the preacher's search for wisdom. Now, who was the preacher? Probably Solomon, not 100% sure, but probably Solomon. But here's what we know definitely about the preacher. The preacher was an ancient Israelite who had lived a long, prosperous life. He had experienced everything that life had to offer. And as he looked back on his life, he tries to find meaning. And really the question that Ecclesiastes gets at is, where is meaning in life? Where can I find meaning? So I want us to begin in chapter 1, verse 1, and read through verse 11. Chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does a man gain by the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, the wind hastens to the place where it rises, the wind blows to the south and goes around to the north and around to the winds, and on the circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the stream flows, there they will flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new. It has already been in the ages before. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to come among those who are to come after. The main point that the preacher makes in the first 11 verses is there's nothing new under the sun. And as you read through these first 11 verses, you just get this sense of monotony, that life is just monotonous. I mean, let's go back into the text, verse 7. The streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they will flow again. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And here there is nothing new under the sun. I mean, don't you just get this sense from the preacher that life is monotonous? And this resonates highly with me. I mean, let me take you through an exciting week in the life of Ryan. So, you know, wake up Monday morning, typically around 7:30, sometimes it's 8:30. But typically wake up about 7:30, hit my alarm clock 3 or 4 times, then get up, go to work, have lunch, have typically write papers or teach class in the afternoon, come home, make dinner, spend some time with Jessica, watch a little TV, go to bed. Then come next morning, wake up, hit my alarm clock, eat breakfast, go to work, have lunch, afternoon work, grade a few papers, make dinner, spend time with Jessica, watch TV, go to bed. Then Wednesday comes. Can y'all guess what's coming? This is a pretty much a normal week. And Jessica and I are very proud of our boringness, but we live a very boring, monotonous life. I mean, Jessica, she wakes up before I do. She goes to school. Her day at school is never monotonous, but the schedule's very monotonous. She comes home with new stories every day, but it's similar stories with the same kids, with the same people, teaching the same things over and over and over again. And what the preacher says resonates highly with me. And when the preacher looks at life, he just comes to recognize life goes on and 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 on. Goes. Where do you find meaning in a life like this? And so he sets up the book, I think, by talking to all of us. Life repeats itself. Life goes on and on. Life's monotonous. Where then do you find meaning? Picking up in verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired a great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So what's the next few verses about? Essentially, the next few verses is that there's sorrow in the search. So as the preacher breaks from this monotony to try to find meaning, and he searches for this meaning, what he recognizes is this is a sorrowful search. It's a sad search. I mean, when you look at the language that he presents here, I, the preacher, have been king in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. He's the king. He has the highest place in the entire nation. And he is having a searching out. This is a diligent, hardworking effort to find meaning. Verse 13, it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and is striving after the wind. Down to verse 18. In much wisdom there is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I got to a point when I was at Florida College when there was a lot of family issues going on. We had lost a few family members. Just family issues were happening. I was taking some philosophy classes that were taught by a very intelligent Christian. But I experienced ideas that challenged my faith. And there was just so a mixture of things in my life that happened that honestly made me stop and question, why am I here? Not why am I here at Florida College, but why am I here on earth? Like, what's the meaning of my life? What's the purpose of my life? I mean, if you take out me teaching classes and writing papers and working on my dissertation, and you fill in the blank with taking classes and doing a few other things, my schedule was pretty much the same, pretty monotonous, repeated over and over again. What's the meaning of all this? Why do I spend years of my life working on education? Why do I spend hours of my life studying? What's the meaning of any of this? And so then as I began, as he says in verse 13, that I apply my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that's done under heaven, I was afraid what I may find. Because my faith was questioned and I really began to deeply question if God exists, I was afraid of the answer. Because what if the answer is that there's no God? Or what if the answer is, I believe in the wrong God? What if the answer is there's multiple gods? What if the answer is we can't know if there's a God? And I began to look in libraries and just look at the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of philosophers who have presented multiple ideas. And I began to consider all the world religions. And I began to consider all the denominations. And I began to consider all the philosophers and all the preachers and all the teachers and all the people that had these great ideas. And how can I know it? Y'all, it's maddening. I mean, whenever you really seek out and you search and you try to find this meaning, you try to find this purpose, it's a maddening search. Because you can never stop reading, you can never stop questioning, you can never stop asking, you can never stop researching. There's always going to be more to question. It's a sorrowful, sorrowful search. So I continue either with my monotonous life and repeat my schedule and repeat my life and repeat my day over and over and over again, or I stop and I have a maddening search to know if there's a God, to know if there's meaning. Which shall I then choose? Down to verse chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with my pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under the life during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female servants, and I had slaves who were born in my house. I had a great possessions and herd and flocks, more than any who had been in Jerusalem before me. I had gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept from my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expanded in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person who has his eyes and his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And he had perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will be forgotten. How the wise dies just like a fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind. Well, then, as the preacher turns and he recognizes the state of his life, ultimately what he comes to recognize, not only is there sorrow in the search, but even more than this, there's vanity in the search. As the preacher begins to recognize the sorrow that comes from his questioning, as the preacher begins to recognize the maddening that comes from his life, he turns to distractions. He's not going to find happiness in the search for meaning. He's not going to find happiness in the search for philosophy. So he distracts himself. He builds up a house greater than any before him. He builds up for himself things far greater than anyone else can do. He tries pleasure. He tries everything. He distracts himself. And y'all, whenever I was in my deepest moments of darkness, in my deepest moments of doubt, you know what I did? I distracted myself from them. I made myself so busy with anything and everything I could just so that I wouldn't have to think about this. Especially as I began to contemplate, what if there is a God who I don't know, and he's going to punish me eternally for it? What if I've missed something? What if there's been something in front of my face all along and I've missed it and I'm going to be damned for it? These type questions are maddening, y'all. And so I turned to schoolwork. I turned to speech and debate. I even turned to church. And got so involved with social events and activities and even Bible studies to distract myself from the real, true, deep, foundational questions. And then I recognized all those distractions. Ultimately, verse 10, whatever my eyes desired to do, I did not keep from it. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart was found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for my toil. But then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and the striving after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So not only has the preacher found that there's sorrow in the search, but even more so what he's found is there's vanity in life. I mean, you think about what the average American does in life. We go to work for 40 plus hours a week, invest our lives in our work. And then what happens 50 years later? If you're in construction, probably the buildings that you've been in will be torn down within a couple hundred years. If you're in the business world, your company's probably going to fall within 100 years. If you're in academia, your work won't get cited within 20 years. If you're a teacher, the students who you taught are going to die in 70, 80 years. I mean, anything that we do, what's the purpose of it? And I know I'm taking a very cynical look at this. But y'all, I don't think we need to underestimate. There are many, many, many people that we interact with daily who have this view of life. Who have such a cynical, horrible, vain view of life. That everything we do is vain. Everything we do is meaningless. Everything we do has no purpose, and there's no purpose to be found in anything that we do, because everything that we're going to do is destroyed. Everything that we put our life in is going to die. Everything that we have is just going to have some horrible end of destruction. We put our life into people, people die. Put our life into materials, they vanish. Life is vain. And once you take away purpose from life, there's nothing left you can give a person. I mean, if you want to drive a man or a woman mad, don't take away their happiness, take away their purpose. What will truly drive someone mad is not taking away stuff from them. What will truly drive someone mad is not giving them a purpose in life. And whenever we look at this view of life, that's the view that the preacher recognizes. So what then does the preacher do? His life's monotonous. The search is sorrowful. Life is vain. What then does he do? Verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows me, and who knows whether he will be a wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and under my wisdom under the sun. This also was vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What then has a man to gain from all the toil and all the striving with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and all his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a man that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting. Only to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving after the wind. So what the preacher concludes with in this section of Ecclesiastes is he gives two different views of life. And the first view that he presents in verses 18 through 23 is that toil leads to sorrow. The ultimate purpose for this is that life has no purpose. Let's read this one more time. Verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I must toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise or fool, yet he will be master of all for which I've toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave up my heart to despair over all of the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What is a man from all the toil and striving of his heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. For most people in America, if they are truly honest with themselves, this has to be their view of life. All of their toil, all of their work, all of their vexation, all of their seeking, all of their journey ultimately just leads to sorrow. Because if there's no ultimate purpose, there's no ultimate meaning behind all of this, I mean, what's the purpose of it? Within my department, that we had a scholar who died about 5 years ago, who was the epitome of an academic scholar. He had published more than any man I've ever met. He was more well-known. He was more on editorial boards. He had an amazing paycheck. And when you looked at all aspects of his life, he was extremely successful. Yet then he got cancer. He got a very aggressive form of cancer that killed him within about a year, I believe. And do you know how much those publications meant to him then? Do you know how much his editorial boards and his awards and his salary and everything else that he had spent 40 years of his life going after had meant to him? Absolutely nothing. It was sorrowful. And when he got cancer and he looked at his life and he tried to figure out, oh, what's the meaning behind all this? There was no meaning behind it. And now, 5 years later, most of the people in my specific branch of communication who study this similar thing as I do, Most have not even heard his name. And that's 5 years later. As I looked at his life, he was a vehement, vehement atheist. All of his work, all of his toil, all it did was lead to sorrow. And I would be utterly ashamed if this is where I had to end the sermon. Because could y'all imagine us living 70, if we're lucky, 100 years on this earth? And all that we toil for, all that we work for, all that we do, all that it does is lead to sorrow. But there's a second view. Beginning in verse 24, there is nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to the one who gives and pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. The second view of life that the preacher presents is that when we look at life, our toil can lead to enjoyment. And the sharp contrast between the two, the contrast that work leading to sorrow or toil leading to sorrow. And then we have this radical, radical claim. I mean, y'all, as we've been reading through the book of Ecclesiastes, what has been the preacher's view of life so far? Happy or sad? It's been horrible. I mean, I'm depressed, and this is after about 20 minutes of reading Ecclesiastes 1 and 2. Like, I just need a Christmas song or something right now. Just because it's depressing. I mean, the view that he's given is just depressing. There's no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no happiness, there's no joy, there's nothing good. Nothing. But then, out of nowhere, here comes this thought. There is nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Why can we find enjoyment in eating and drinking? Because this also is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? When we look at the true meaning of life, and we look at the true meaning of our work, and we look at the true meaning of our toil, the reason that our work and our toil have meaning in them is not because of an inherent quality of them, but it's because it's given by God. Ultimately, true purpose and true meaning cannot be found in God. It's utterly impossible for us to look at our life, for us to look at the meaning, and for us to find the purpose in it. I mean, you take, for example, I'm going to pick on Mike for a second. Mike, who works on cars. Mike, have you ever had a car worked on that you didn't think was going to have to go out of commission at some point? Probably not. Every car that Mike has probably ever had a hand in fixing, he knows at some point, some sooner than others, they're going to get in a collision again, they're going to get totaled, they're just going to fall apart, they're going to get 300,000 miles. At some point, those cars are going to fall apart. And if you take the view of the atheist, all that does is lead to sorrow. Because you fix one car and then there's another, and then that car is just going to fall apart, so why even fix it in the first place? Well, it's because the meaning in his work, I'm going to venture to say, is not because working in and of itself has that meaning. But he has a higher purpose and a higher calling and a higher meaning in that because it's from the hand of God. He recognizes he can be a Christian and use the Christian work ethic and use the Christian moral standards and show the glory of Christ to every last one of his customers. Whenever I've been in so many of your houses, and almost every single one of you have said, yeah, Brother Raymond added this one over here. Either Raymond or Arter or somebody added something. I have no idea, Imogene, how many houses Raymond either built or fixed or something. Did Raymond, you think for a minute, ever really think that those houses were going to stay up through eternity? Oh, no, of course not. But every single one of you have said, he did a top quality job. And he exemplified Colossians 3:23. Whatever you do, do heartily as for the Lord and not for man. Whatever your heart finds to do, do as for Christ and not for men. The real meaning in what we live and the real meaning in what we do is not inherent in work, but it comes from our Father. Mike recognizes that whenever he fixes a car, that car is going to get totaled at some point. But he can serve God. He can live out the life of a Christian. And he can one day take all the principles he's lived out. He can provide for his family, as 1 Timothy commands. And he can provide, and he can live it out, because that one day, those cars are going to fall apart, but Christ Jesus and his kingdom are going to be around for eternity. And y'all, I urge you to think deeply. Why am I here? Am I here because life is monotonous? Do I think that the search is sorrowful? Do I think that life is vain? Or do I recognize work in and of itself is never going to have that purpose? The only purpose that we can find is really from the purpose of a higher being, of a higher creator, of God. Now, very briefly, how does this show us that God exists? For me, when I went through my deep struggle of questioning God's existence, I got to this crossroad. I either had to accept life is meaningless, life is purposeless, life has no morality, there's no goodness, there's no righteousness, there's no right, there's no wrong, there's no good, there's no bad, or there's a God who's given purpose. There's a God who's given meaning. There's a God who's given goodness. There's a God who's given righteousness. There's a God who's given morality. There's a God who's provided all of these things. The conclusion that all of life has no meaning, that all of life has no purpose, that there's no such thing as morality, to me was utterly rejectable. Because how can you go through this life and claim there's no such thing as morality? How can you go through this life and truly claim that there's no purpose at all? And I don't think, if I can answer the argument that I think that may be provided against me, this was not just an emotional decision. It wasn't just I arbitrarily said, either I accept there's a God so I feel better about myself, or I accept the truth that there is no meaning in life. But as I looked at the world around me and I looked at all the different evidence that was there, the conclusion that had to be reached was, there is surely a God. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting. Only to the one who pleases God. What holds your life together? One final verse before we close. Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1. I would venture to say that nearly all of us here this evening have gone through at least one, if not multiple times in our life, where we just feel there's no meaning. All of life is miserable. All of life is purposeless. All of life has nothing greater to it. The question we have to ask ourselves is, what holds my life together? What holds it together? Colossians 1 verse 15. He is, that is Christ, the Son, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created. And in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And He is before all things. And in Him, all things held together. I had a choice to make. Was I allow my life to be meaningless and purposeless and chaos filled? Or was I going to allow Christ Jesus to hold my life together? The preacher had to make the choice. Paul had to make the choice. I had to make the choice. The question I then have is, what do you choose? To live in a world where there's no God? To live in a world of no meaning, of no purpose, of no morality? Or to recognize His existence is clearly seen, namely His invisible attributes and eternal power, by the things that are seen? Get out your songbooks, please. It may very well be that there is someone who's here this evening who's struggling with the question, does God exist? Whenever I went through my doubts, I was ashamed of my doubts at first. I was just like, how can I doubt this? How in the world can I, as someone who's been raised in a home with both parents who believe in God, all my grandparents believe in God, all of my cousins, all of my aunts, all of my uncles, everyone around me believes in God, everyone that I'm close to believes in God, how can I question this? But then what was interesting was, as I turned to men who were much wiser than I, nearly everyone had gone through some level of this question. And it was only whenever I recognized I had to get over the shame and I had to own up to the question, I had to own up to its responsibility, and I even had to own up to the answer that I was going to receive, that I was able to work through this question, to think about it, to pray about it. And then the existence of God was clearly seen. It was clearly seen in creation. It was seen in morality. It was seen in the world. And it was even seen in my life. Does God exist? If you need help, if you want the prayers of the congregation, if you need your faith strengthened, if your faith has been wavering, if you've been vacillating between the ways of doubt and the ways of certainty, between the ways of faith and the ways of the world, let your brethren help you. If you need anything this evening, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.